Good morning. We're ready to start now, I think. Welcome, everybody. My name is Frances Ezzy Jorgensen. I'm a member of the Management Forum Steering Committee, and it's my pleasure to be chairing this session today, a question and answer period with Provost Massey. Like his beloved Dodgers, Anthony Massey left his hometown of Brooklyn, New York, for greener fields. Whereas the Dodgers landed in L.A., Provost Massey came to Montreal via Italy and Providence, Rhode Island, to join McGill faculty as an assistant professor of sociology. Excuse me. That was more than 30 years ago, and as he often indicates, he has never regretted that decision, not even for one moment. Professor Massey's administrative work at McGill began with the development of the Social Science Statistics Laboratory and its subsequent transformation into a faculty-wide information technology support service, of which he was its first director. He also served the Faculty of Arts as an associate dean with multiple portfolios. In October 2000, he became the vice principal of Information Systems and Technology. Principal Heather Monroe Bloom named him the Deputy Provost and Chief Information Officer in April 2003. He was then appointed to the position of Provost in 2005. As Provost, he is the Chief Academic Officer of the University after the Principal, and he has oversight and responsibility for the strategies, planning and development, implementation and assessment of all academic policies and programs, student services, libraries and related services, and other key responsibilities, including faculty appointments and tenure. The provost is also responsible for the university's overall budget and for the allocation of funds and other resources in alignment with the university's academic priorities. In addition to serving as provost, Professor Massey is a former football and rugby player, an avid reader, a member of the National Statistics Council of Canada, and foreign member of the Italian Research Council and Scientific Committee. He was recently appointed Cavalier in the Order of Merit in the Italian Republic. In the fall of 2010, the provost addressed a plenary session of Management Forum in this very room. During the question and comment period of that session, it became apparent that there was a great need for managers to have a voice. Professor Massey recognized the value of the manager's role in identifying areas for improvement, streamlining administrative processes, and recommending changes to procedures. He is here today to learn of your suggestions and your concerns. Please join me in welcoming Professor Anthony Massey.
Thank you. Thank you, Fran. It's difficult to live up to what you just said, because the budget is really on my mind today, in particular since the Quebec government will announce its budget later this afternoon. The first budget measure that I am announcing is that you are all admitted to this room free of charge, but you'll have to pay to get out. And you'll have to pay more if you leave early. Usually in these sessions, I'd like to start, even though I'm, as Fran said, a Dodger fan, there were a couple of New York Yankees who I did admire. Difficult for me to say that. But one is Yogi Berra. And here, you've got to be very careful if you don't know where you are going, because you might not get there. That's the reason for planning, right, just in case. One of the things that I wanted to talk about today is to talk a little bit about the things that Fran mentioned, that managerial staff at McGill are very important. We learned a lot last year from a forum like this. Early on, when I was an administrator at McGill, I took the role with Morty Yalofsky of going to these sessions at least twice a year, trying to understand the ways in which the university functioned from the point of view of the people who have to carry the burden of the day-to-day administrative life and managerial tasks of the university, because many of you have skills that you could be applying in almost any type of organization, yet you've chosen to work at a university. And therefore, it's important that we bring to you some of the things that we're thinking about as academics, and you bring to us the expertise that will help us to realize them, and you bring to us as well some of your own thoughts about better processes, procedures, and practices, because if we have better policies, procedures, practices, then we avoid problems. So it's a really important thing to have this type of interaction. Instead of starting with the very first slide on what some of the things we're thinking about, I'm actually going to turn it around for a moment. There's a big crowd, and it might be intimidating for some of you, but if you have any questions you'd like to ask, why don't you ask them now? Because if you wait until I'm finished, my presentation might not cover the things that you're interested in, and we might not have enough time. So I want to give you a chance right off the bat to ask questions that you might be on your mind or concerns that you might have. Yes? Yeah. Well, that's a really great question. We think that the things that will be contained... Oh, yes, let me repeat the question. The question was, since the budget of Quebec is coming down this afternoon, if we held this meeting tomorrow, would it have a different content? Well, it would probably have a different tone, because we know exactly what the government is prepared to do with regard to funding higher education. So we don't know right now what they actually have in mind with regard to the proposals for making up the shortfall in the budget that was created because of a change in government. Back in March of last year, when we prepared the budget for the university, we were expecting a $325 increase per 30 credits of enrollment, and about, we expected 30% or so of that would be clawed back for the government's own financial aid package to Quebec-based students. After the budget was announced and brought to our Board of Governors, the Liberal government began to change its mind about what the increase would be and announced that it would be a $254 increase with 40% taken back for student aid. By the time the PQ government got to power, they made an announcement in several different days that they were not going to entertain any increases in tuition for this year and probably not for next year as a minimum. And that created about a $6 to $7 million budget shortfall for McGill in the current budget year. So if they announce anything more drastic than that, then it will have serious consequences for our ability to meet obligations that we have. So there would be some additional information, but right now the budget that's in course will be maintained. Even though we're going to run a larger deficit than was projected because of the change in the tuition policy, and because the government has said it's only going to provide about 60% of the shortfall that the universities will experience because of the lack of tuition increases and a lack of funding from other sources in other government revenues to cover the commitments that the Liberals had made with regard to making up the underfunding at universities. So yeah, I would expect that tomorrow I'd have more information, but I usually rain on parades, but in this case I'm not looking forward to this afternoon's announcements. Yes. So the question was, if the government will announce what its plans are to either increase revenues or cut expenditures, and part of those cuts will undoubtedly come to universities, and the question is, what are we planning to cut? And I said, for this year's budget, right off the bat, nothing. I can't cut anything that's been committed already. Most of the commitments made at the university now have already taken effect. They included a June salary policy increase. They include the ability of new professors to come on board, some additional personnel to support them in different areas. Once those commitments have been made from the Office of the Provost in the budget to the individual units, we're not going back and pulling out right now. It means, however, that planning for next year will have to change, because if the government makes up 60% of the shortfall this year, and decides it's a one-time only infusion and doesn't increase tuition or the grant next year, then the budget for 2014 will be severely affected. And that's going to require consultation with the community about the areas in which we can cut, because we can't, I cannot take that kind of a decision without hearing from people and the effects that it's likely to have. That means deans with regard to faculties, VPs with regard to the units that they report to, and consultations like the one we're having now. You know? So if you have a good suggestion about what we could cut, let me know. There must be another question somewhere hidden in there. I haven't had this much silence since teaching introductory statistics. The second line says contingent on several factors, including today's Quebec budget announcement. So it's very different. So the question was, is that proposed policy going to take effect on June 1st? That's a proposed policy, and it parallels the kinds of increases that have been present in the past, a component across the board, a component for merit. The problem is we don't know what the budget is actually going to look like come May 1st of this year, and that's because we don't have the announcement yet. So back to the very first question, there is a lot that's contingent on knowing what the Quebec government's funding priorities are going to be. And but we already know they're not going to include, at least through the next academic year, an increase in tuition. That much I think we've been pretty well guaranteed given the communiques that have been received and the press, the things we've read about in the press from the present minister. Who's completely shifted focus from Quebec being underfunding universities to Quebec funding at an appropriate level. And the only reason that that comes across is because Quebec universities, Montreal, Laval, Sherbrooke, McGill, do quite well in research grants. And that's not money coming from the provincial government for the most part. It's coming from the federal government. And if you take that out, then the per capita student expenditures in Quebec are falling behind other provinces. And that's something that you can only make up for in one of two ways. You can increase tuition or you can increase the grant. Now, we could diversify revenue streams in some ways, but those are really marginal compared to the two big components of the operating budget. So contingent on today's announcement, that is the proposed policy. Well, I think the proposed is we would like to go forward if we had the budgetary resources with what I think has been a conversation between components of the management staff and HR. I'm not part of that group that discusses that. So, but I think that that's what the proposed increases that I have to try to put into a budget look like that. But they're based on a projection of revenues that we right now don't have. Just to be clear, this year's budget, which ends in the spring, we proposed a $7 million deficit to the Board of Governors, and they accepted it. Then we got the announcement about no tuition increases and a lack of willingness to fund at 100% the government's commitment. So we added to that approximately another $6 million. So that would have bring this year's deficit to $13 million. Now, it took us 5 years to bring McGill's budget into balance. And for 3 years in a row, we've had a more or less balanced budget. And I say more or less because sometimes we've actually had slight surplus that we've been able to use to cover some of the accumulated deficit. And other years, we were within hundreds of thousands of dollars on a $720 million budget of balancing. So it's kind of noise in the system. So we've had three really good years of balancing the budget, even though it's been tight. We've been able to do it. But this year we couldn't meet our commitments by balancing the budget, and the Board of Governors understood that there's a financing problem for Quebec universities like McGill, and it's mostly about universities like McGill that are underfunded, and that is universities that have a high intensity of research. Our facilities, in McGill's case, facilities are older, and we don't get an appropriate amount of money to fix the buildings that we live in, and so we have to take out additional obligations. So that's the long answer to contingent on this afternoon. Other questions? Yes.
And I know that there has been some consultation among administrative staff, and staff included. To what extent, or what have been some of the major concerns that have been brought forth by the administrative staff, and to what extent is that being considered in the selection process?
Right. So there is an advisory committee for the selection of a new principal. I'm not a member of it, and it's run by the chair of the board and the chancellor of the university. It's actually the chairman of the board, Kip Cobbett, who chairs that committee, and I know they've held meetings. All of us as vice principals and all of the deans, and I know several of the higher level managerial directors of units reporting into vice principals have been before the committee to present information. The actual hearings that they hold are confidential, so I don't know any more than you do what has actually been discussed in the committee. I just know that, well, I know what I told them. Sorry, I can't answer any more than it's a selection process that is advisory to the chair of the board, who eventually has to make a recommendation to the full board for the appointment of a new principal at McGill. And it will go on, I'm sure, all winter and into the spring. Any other? Yes.
Going back to the shortfall, was there a plan B in case the tuition hike will not go forward? Like, literally said yes, and then the right. Government comes in, they'll give the money back.
So, whenever we do a budget, so is there a plan B in light of the fact that the government's funding is not always stable? So we always have multiple scenarios for budgeting. You can't budget the university of this size to the exact penny. That's true for revenues as well as for expenses, because some things just come up that you couldn't have anticipated, including additional revenues. So even in this budget year, we have some positives in the budget that we didn't anticipate because of recalculations of some of the grant that from previous years or other sources of revenues that were dribbling in and now became solid. So we always have to have contingency plans in the university's budget. But when we get a budget approved, it's on the basis of the best available information that we have. And if you commit to a unit, this is how much you have to spend. It's very, I personally find it inappropriate to then go back to that unit and say, actually, I want it back. We'll have to make an adjustment in the next year's budget to make up that shortfall. So we have an accumulated deficit at McGill. That we also we're servicing a debt on of about $100 million at about 1% interest. So right now that only means $1 million. And I say only as if I had a lot of $1 million, right? But it's only $1 million in debt servicing on the accumulated deficit on a $700 million plus budget. So it's not that onerous. What we really worry about is what happens if short-term interest rates go up. What happens to our ability then to start, will be start eating away at what are priorities for the university. I think another thing you have to think about, we can plan for the overall permanent expenditures of the university pretty well. It's the one-time only expenditures that really create deficit or surplus situations. The ongoing commitments, even without the increase in tuition, we can manage the teaching programs at the university. We can manage the salaries of the individuals who are in the teaching component of the university and for the administrative staff who are covered by the permanent operating budget, because that's easy enough to calculate without the increases. So all of the things that are increases, we need to have plans to cover contingency plans to cover what happens if we don't get this particular line item. And we try to do that by only making temporary allocations to units where appropriate, because we can't count on it over the long term. And we do a low, medium, and high projection of the revenue sources for the university and a low, lower, and lowest projection on our expenditures if we can. Any other questions? Well, you can ask questions at any time during my presentation if you want to. There's a microphone there. There are people, I want to welcome the people at McDonald campus who are watching this on a live stream, and if they have any questions, there's a Polycom available for them, and they can also ask questions if we get a signal that they actually want to ask a question from our AV technicians. So the first thing is the key issues for the staff. We've already touched upon it. There's a proposed salary increase that would be 2% merit, 1.5% economic or across-the-board increase, but it is contingent on several factors, not the least of which is the announcement today about revenue sources for the university coming from the grant or tuition, although, I emphasize I don't anticipate that there'll be any announcement of tuition increases in time for us to do anything, because they'll probably await the outcome of the variety of summits and pre-summits that the government is holding on the university sector. Achieving strategic academic priorities is the second version of McGill's strategic academic plan, and it concluded a series of working groups that dealt with best practices and career development for the administrative and support staff at the university, and members of this audience and members of the group that lead you have played a key role in helping to get feedback on the things we want to bring to HR for consideration and back to faculties for career development opportunities. And very important, the feedback we've gotten from people here over time and in these meetings about things that would make McGill work better, how to streamline some of our processes, how to automate and implement business practices that are part of or will become part of the workforce planning initiative. And there we have government policy at work, and I'll come back to that in a minute, but it is something we have to do in terms of government requirements. One of the things that came out of last year's meeting was a suggestion by Connie DiGiuseppe on how to automate procedures for new academic hires. Now, we haven't fully automated that procedure, but units in the Faculty of Arts and some in science and elsewhere across the university are already using third-party providers for automating the process of academic hires at the university. And we're developing a project called R2R, which is Recruitment to Retirement. And that was a package of issues for recruiting academic staff, for recruiting administrative staff, for managing talent at the university, and for establishing procedures for terminations that was approved in April of this year and is now in the process of phased implementation. And it really came out of a suggestion that we heard here that we were not doing something we should be doing. So don't be shy about, I know Connie doesn't need to be told that, but don't be shy about recommending things, because if we can, we'll try to implement them. But even if they're not immediately implemented, they form part of the concerns that we continually think about as we move on. We did solicit questions. I'd like to thank the organizers for doing this, from the audience, or from those of you who are likely to be here ahead of time. So we had some questions that were prepackaged, but I did want to give you a chance to answer some ahead of time. The first question that came up is, what's the relationship between strategic planning and workforce planning? Well, there's actually a very important link between the two, because one of the objectives that we had in strategic planning was to make sure that there was career development opportunities available to administrative and support staff at McGill. As I said earlier, what you do, you could be doing in most cases in other industries, other sectors of the economy, but you're at a university. So how can we link your skills back into achieving McGill's strategic academic priorities? And workforce planning, while initially stimulated by something outside of the university, a 1-for-2 replacement policy, a cut of 10% in expenditures on administrative salaries, basically, in the university, comes from Bill 100. But we didn't think it was appropriate just to take the bill as it is, but rather to try to customize how we would handle it at McGill. And so a project on workforce planning was proposed to try to even the what will have to undoubtedly be uneven effects of any policy that only allows a one-for-two replacement. What if two people leave in exactly the same unit? How are we going to handle that? What if we don't get a sufficient number of replacements in terms of meeting both the numbers and the budget requirement? How are we going to deal with that? How are people who remain going to be able to deal with the work that they have? All of those questions form part of what is the Workforce Planning Initiative, but we want it to be integrated into our strategic thinking about how you can best support, as administrative and support staff, the academic mission of the university. Because, again, it should be your interest in working at a university should be about the university's mission and goals and how you, using your talents and skills, can best serve that particular mission. So they're intimately related. We need to have a workforce plan not only for our academic staff but for our students, but also for the people who provide the services. So that's the way in which they're integrated. Any follow-up? Okay. The second question actually is interesting because it deals with professors. It said, McGill's professors have largely been trained to a 20th century world, some to a 19th century world. So how can we ensure that they meet the expectations of the born digital generations who are already enrolled as undergraduates here? That's a really important question, and I'm glad it came from somebody in this audience or someone in your group. Rather than coming from my office or from other professors, because it really shows that there's a sensitivity to the relationship between the teaching mission of the university, the student-centeredness that we claim to have, and the kinds of activities in which our professors are engaged and how they teach our students. It's a really fundamental question. And we've been thinking about it for a long time at McGill. Over the last 4 years, we've begun to develop a coalition of four different groups across the campus. One is our teaching and learning services, and that's to provide a sound pedagogical base for professors about what it means to be a good university instructor. The second is our content and collaboration solutions from the IT group at McGill, because they provide the support for the learning management system that we have now available to professors and students. So those two groups are really fundamental. The third group is the library. The library is important because many professors use course packs, and they print them, right? They have them printed and sold at the bookstore. When we have to have them printed, we often have to buy a second license, right, for the copyright, to cover copyright costs. And then we have to pass that on to students. So now we're destroying trees, and we are having our students pay additional fees, and we have all of the associated costs with running it through the bookstore. Libraries have discovered that with about 90% of all the material that goes into course packs, we already own the electronic copyright for. So if we linked our students' course packs electronically inside the learning management system, and professors were well trained enough to know how to use them, then we would be saving money, and we'd be responding immediately to a born digital requirement that students wouldn't have to go and get it on paper. They may print it themselves, but they wouldn't need to. And the fourth element in doing this is the physical spaces in which professors teach. And we began a process of renovating, we've done about 6 classrooms now across the campus, and a couple of laboratories. One has already been completed, and a few others are in the planning, so that the actual layout of the rooms reflects the way in which you would teach face-to-face with students who are used to having immediate access to digital information. So that's how we're trying to bring those things together, but it won't be sufficient, because we won't be able to do this alone. No university has the capacity to really pull that off by itself. So we've created a project which is called McGill Innovative Learning Environments. And again, it depends on being able to rally sufficient resources from funding other than tuition or government grants. So we're looking for partners in terms of philanthropic giving. It's the only way in which we could actually fund something this big. And here we want to create a teaching innovations complex to help prepare professors better. So that means faculty developers and support staff need to be available to professors in terms of learning how to teach in this new way. We need to reimagine what our library is. Right now, hundreds of thousands, actually millions, of volumes sit on shelves and are never circulated. And over time, in many of our libraries, the amount of material that does circulate has been going drastically down as attendance, physical, you know, turnstile attendance in libraries has gone up, and the use of the libraries as social learning spaces for students becomes more important. So we're using a prime downtown facility, the main McLennan Library, but also the other libraries, as very expensive warehouses for materials that never circulate. And we really need to rethink that. So we have to reimagine what the library could be. And that means a focus on those digital resources we already have available, protect the important work that many people who use volumes, who still look at volumes, can have access to, and think about whether we can renovate those physical spaces. The third thing we have to do, and we've already begun this process, is upgrade our technology. We've got a new learning management system. It's called Desire to Learn inside of My Courses. We have to continue to upgrade that. And the fourth thing, which will become probably the most controversial part of this, is we need to form partnerships with other universities. And the ones that we're focusing most of our attention on right now is a potential partnership with Harvard, MIT, Berkeley, and the University of Texas called edX. And that would provide us with an opportunity to learn about how you put technology to work to improve on-campus education, while at the same time learning about how people use these technologies in what are called MOOCs, massively open online courses. So that's called MILE, McGill Innovative Learning Environments. Any questions on that? Yes.
Right.
Right. That's a great question. Are our students really as digital as we're assuming they are, and are we using students in the process? We've used students in the focus groups on choosing the learning management system, and we've used students in helping us to understand the different types of furnishings that could go into different facilities. And if you walk over to the library, you'll see a whole area that's now available for experimenting with different types of seating so that students can make choices, and they're actually there to judge that. And we're also trying to get better analytics on what students say about courses that are using digital content. So we're trying to make sure that our Mercury. Everything starts with an M, right? So the Mercury course evaluation system gets better responses, and we're trying to customize it to see whether or not digital content and the use of the learning management system can be improved by the kinds of responses we get back from students. I spend a lot of time going out to student groups, and one of the things that we continually hear when I make this presentation to student groups is it resonates with them. They still want face-to-face contact. They still want to learn. But their way of approaching information, and that's why the libraries are such an important part of this, is really different than the generations that preceded them. It's at their fingertips in a way that many of us still have difficulty in accommodating. They're very used to getting information immediately. But a lot of the information, they don't know how to filter. And so, again, we need professional librarians and professors to help them understand that information better and to use the digital tools that are available. So it's a good question, but we think that most are moving in a direction that wants more digital content, and they're moving faster than most of our professors in getting there.
What about people like
Right. That's another great question. Now, we're working with IT groups to make sure that all of the pages available at McGill actually have the ability to be viewed on different mobile devices, and I think our IT group is on top of trying to get us there. I think we have a problem of content on a lot of the pages, where the content is not upgraded sufficiently quickly, and that's something where this group can really be of great use in terms of the units in which you work, to stimulate and push the professors or your own supervisors, if you have them, or if you're the supervisor, take the responsibility to try to ensure that the quality of the information is up to what we expect and that we're actually serving the population by having it in the right format. Anyone? Yes. So it's a really good question as well. It's what are we doing to orient new professors to a different set of expectations? How are we helping them through their early career so that they see this as an important contributor to their role in educating students? And what are the mechanisms that we can use to ensure that it's there? So the first part is on orientation for all new professors actually starts here. For all professors, we have a session on an orientation session, and we have a breakfast usually at the Teaching and Learning Services first, or they're the first presenters. So we're trying to make sure that people don't view the Teaching and Learning Services as a service of last resort. When you've gotten really bad teaching evaluations and you're worried if you're going to get renewed or get tenure, then go to them. That's not the way we want to view it. We want it to be right the very first day you get on the campus. This is a group you should be working with to ensure that the second component of McGill's definition of itself, research intensive but student centered, really matters. So teaching evaluations and the use of technology in the classroom and the ways in which professors think about designing their courses and programs all form part of a teaching dossier, which does have an impact on renewal and promotion to tenure. It also has an impact on promotion to full professor, although it's at a lower level once you're establishing your international credentials as a researcher. It's really important that professors at McGill recognize that they're at a university. I said that for you earlier, but it's also for our professors, because some of them sometimes think that they're at a research institute. They're at a university, and so contributions to pedagogical programs, contributions at whatever level you're teaching at, you have students at, is really important. So that's, if you're teaching undergraduates, fine. Some units don't have undergraduates. That means you have to be a really good graduate supervisor, right? So we want to make sure that that component is heard early and is acted on. This is a good question. Anyone else? The third question was on consultation. Well, I'm here. Take your best shot. I think it's important that we do hear from people, and this is we're just taking the questions that came. So it is important to get information from people who are at the shop floor, in quotes, level. It is a valuable step to hear things that could help us change our procedures. And I've been going out to faculty councils, and administrative and support staff are often invited to those councils. Sometimes they're not, but in most cases they are. I've been going to student groups, and I come to this session at least once a year. So we know we need more of that, but there's only so many hours in a day. So we also think we could use electronic communication better. And if we have a web page and we have an email address, and suggestions are received and we are incorporating them into the strategic plan of the, and we have incorporated them into ASAP 2012. So consultation is really important, hearing from you is important, and we won't be able to do workforce planning without direct consultation of the individuals involved. Because as units change the composition, as people leave, and if we only have a 1-for-2 replacement, somewhere in the university there's going to be a major effect. And we have to be ready to respond to it, and we have to be able to give people the tools to rethink the jobs that they have to do. We do a lot of layering at McGill. So if you look at, you probably think of it yourself, as you look at your own job over time, you've added more things. You continually layer on new and other things. You have to prioritize, and at some point your job really changes and some things you can abandon and no one will really notice. I think it's important for you to be the ones to make that determination and to have a dialogue with your colleagues, with your own supervisors, or with those who report to you about the changing nature of job expectations for all of you. It has to happen. Universities and workplaces evolve. We layer, add more things, we rarely subtract until it becomes a burden. And then all of a sudden, we can collapse. So you really have to think about yourself. What is it in your job that's the most important contribution you're making to the success of McGill and to your own career development? And what is it that really could be put on a back burner or stored or abandoned? There are things that we all can do in that regard, and we have to think about it. Any suggestions? No. You're waiting for the end. There's one. Oh, Connie, there it is.
We send our suggestions to your office, because a lot of the leaders are actually coming from the top down.
Yeah. Right. As I said, she's not shy. That's okay.
So,
yeah. Within the context of the strategic paper, absolutely. In other words, on career development for administrative and support staff, you should feel free to do that. I will pass them on to Lynn Gervais, who's in the back of the room here, because we have to work as a partnership. We need to make sure that our HR policies are consonant with the mission and goals of the university. So if there's a good suggestion about how to make a change, we'll try to implement it. So absolutely, you can send them on to whitepaper@mcgill.ca. Yes. I didn't hear you. Okay. So there'll be a feedback survey sent out to all of you, and that will be one of the things we'll put on the link. Any other follow-ups? Yes. Yeah, that's a good point. And I know there are groups on 1010 Sherbrooke, other groups on Du Rocher, other groups that are in rental space in 550 Sherbrooke and elsewhere along. So trying to get out is important. It is a question of trying. Usually if I'm invited, I'll come. If I just show up, it might not be that welcome. But it's important if you think that's important, Brian, then you should make sure that you send a note, and we'll try to get out there and meet with individual groups. I like these groups because you get 180 people or so in a room, and others out at Mac. It's easier than having to repeat over and over. I try not to say the same words, although I hope the content is consistent. But it is important to try to give feedback and get consultation about the things that are important. Yes?
In context
of the workforce planning, what sort of flexibility and what sort of guidance do managers get? Right. I think that's an important HR question. The question was, in the context of trying to have a workforce planning initiative in which there is a redundancy issue related to attrition only, what are the implications for managerial staff of having to deal with a unionized environment? Because we're looking at a one for two kind of across the board in terms of our workforce planning. And what are the implications of that for the types of definitions of positions that have to be covered in a unionized environment? But I think we need to make sure HR, and I see looking Lynn shaking her head, HR will be providing some guidance as the project progresses. We're about 5 months into the beginning of the workforce planning initiative, and we're still learning about the implications that it can have on units that undergo more loss, more attrition than anticipated. But we're also feeling the budgetary implications, I should be really clear about that, of having less mobility than we anticipated. The economic downturn can't be helping much. The issues related to pensions can't be helping much. So we're getting less mobility than was expected. The Workforce Planning Initiative was a projection based on the, and so we didn't have a budget cut. I'll come back to that in a minute. So it was based on what we looked like natural attrition occurring at the university. But if that attrition is slowed down, then the actual, back to the actual deficit that we're going to run is going to be bigger, because we won't have witnessed the potential savings that were expected. So it's a big question at the budgetary level. It's a big question for people who are living through it, and for those of you who are squashed in the middle, getting good advice from HR will be really important, and I'm sure Lynn will provide that. And there were several questions that we're going to pass on to HR. There's a question that was put forward is, how can we improve the quality of leadership at all levels at McGill, and how are current leaders developing or improving their own leadership skills? And this was a set of career development workshop recommendations from the working group are part of the ASAP document. So if you go online and look at the consultations that we've undertaken, the career development work group made significant recommendations about leadership, and we do have a leadership program run through HR, so that's important that we get there. In the last three, that's one question. The second question was, in the last 3 years, my unit has lost a significant amount of management employees under the age of 35 who are taking our IP. I guess that means intellectual property, but I guess it really means, I don't know that we had any. You can't take it away if it's training or, yeah, skills, and know how to, our competitor institutions are making them more competitive. What real investments are being made to retain and develop middle management at the university and creating parity among titles, levels, positions with our competitors in the rest of Canada? So that's another question that I think our AVP HR will be well positioned to answer, but I'm going to just try to take a quick stab at it. Turnover at McGill is not particularly high. When we look at the turnover rates at the university, individual units may be experiencing more. We don't know how much are local pockets and how much is generalizable to the whole university. That's one of the benefits of the workforce planning initiative, is that we're going to learn more about ourselves because of this attrition and the need to smooth things out over a variety of units. I think that there's been a real attempt at McGill over the last decade to try to understand the job titles and positions, not only of the unionized employees, but also of our managers, and to develop a set of skill expectations that are part of the performance dialogues that you're supposed to undertake. So if we're not, and I think I love the question because it actually focuses not only on what we are doing internally, baselining ourselves, but benchmarking against competitor universities. Two of the four are clearly competitors, University of Toronto and Western, because they're part of this group called the U15 research universities across the country. But right now, we put a lot of emphasis on our academic staff in terms of recruitment, because we recruit from all over the world. It's very clearly an international market. And when we have a collectively bargained agreement, it's about bargaining, so it's much more local. But managerial staff are, as someone pointed out right here, in the middle. And so there, the cooperative wage survey with other employers in the city or other universities is really important. And so Lynn will take that back to get an answer for. Thanks.
Just to give you some insight, when we started looking at the workforce planning statistics and data that we initially sent out to the units and the faculty, we had about a 4% turnover overall in the university. But when you drill down, we have a higher percent of turnover with our employees 0 to 3, 0 to 5 years. And so we, the units at the moment, and we've just sent more statistics out to the unit in terms of more detail and more look at in terms of drilling down to see why is that occurring. One of the initial questions that we have no answers to, but that we're puzzled by, is it because when they do come in, the new employees, they have difficulty integrating? Is our culture such that we're not inclusive in terms of the acceptance of new employees in our in those ranks? The other thing that we find also, and we've need to get the data on it in more detail, is it's a generation under 35 that have much more mobility and move through companies much more quickly than others over the age of 35. Others over the age of 35, that generation, we came in, we stayed at a company, and we were much more stable in terms of staying with an employer. So is that a partial comparison? To answer your question on do we compare ourselves and all of the titles and so on, we just hired, as most of you know, Diana Dutton has moved on to another role in HR, and so as she was doing compensation before, now we've replaced her with Madame Quirin, Alice Quirin, who's just joined us. And one of her mandates is look at the amount of titles that we have in the managerial rank. We have 1,000 titles. We have titles that we don't even understand what they are because it's manager of, and there's like 5 letters of acronyms attached to them. So we've introduced the project to the HR advisors in your units and in your faculties, and also your service representatives and those who do a little bit of HR and a little bit of finance and everything else, in terms of a project. And we're going to get back to them once we do some kind of a cleanup in terms of suggestions of creating some sense in the multiple titles that we have, and we're comparing ourselves outside. So we'll have some data to be able to say how are we with the rest of Canada and the university world. To answer your first question, how do we improve the quality of the leadership on all levels at McGill? We have an excellent leadership development program. It has been awarded, recognized, copied. We have the University of Guelph, the University of Saskatchewan, and the University of Memorial in within the next 2 weeks just coming in to see us about our leadership development program. We would love to be able to do many, many, many more cohorts than we do. But again, it's a resource constraint. But that is one of the leading programs that we have for our leadership level at McGill. We've tailored it to have 3 different streams now because our members told us, the participants told us, the community told us, let's focus on those who have supervisory capability or in a sense in their job description, focus on those who have to do academic advising, and focus on those who want to do change or implement change in their units. So we have a core base for those leaders that are taking that 1-year course and then 3 streams for them to specialize in it. Can we do more? We would love to be able to do many more cohorts, but it's a question of restriction in terms of resources. So, and any other follow-ups, you can just direct them to me, and I'll gladly clarify anything for you.
Thank you, Lynn. The fifth question was, oh, yes, sorry.
Just to illustrate that I'm in that group there. personally, I think I would, the leadership program is nice, but I would prefer to have more access to the School of Management, the Desert Tusk School of Management. I'm doing my MBA right now. I'm doing it at John Wilson. And I get a lot of chuckles from my
you just did.
Colleagues there, mainly because it costs $15,000 to do an MBA at John Wilson. I know it's a lot more here at the Guild. So, I mean, to have some kind of preferential or some kind of access to Des Hotel would be great from my perspective. That from 0 to 3 and 0 to 5, the attrition is higher. Well, I'm on a contract. I'm on a 5-year term, second year in. I have a mortgage, I have a wife, and I have 2 kids. So come my 4th year, I'm going to start looking for other work. So this to me, I mean, I would love to stay with you for the next 25 years, but I need some kind of promise or commitment made on the part of McGill where I can reciprocate. So from my perspective, that I'm young and I can go work anywhere. Like, that's not true. I spent my last job was in the Canadian Forces. I served 12 years in the Canadian Forces. So I left because I wanted more stability. I didn't want to move around every 2 years. And, you know, I didn't want to go back to Afghanistan or God knows where. I did my bit. So, you know, that to me, I'm looking for stability as well. But I'm just looking for that commitment, which I don't. So that's my comment on this.
Right. They're good comments. The issue on for academics, it's 0 to 3, 0 to 6. The mobility is the highest, and of course that's because we have a tenure system that we don't renew. So a cohort of 100 new professors coming in, only about 60 to 65 will come up for tenure. So you get a drop off over the first 6 years. That doesn't mean we should run the same kind of a system for our employees who are not on a tenure track and not in the academic mission. So we need to think about ways in which we can provide some level of stability. But job security in the long run really does depend on your ability to produce. And being renewed is a function of two things, your ability to produce and our ability to have the revenues to support it. And right now, the budget revenues at McGill are not sufficient to guarantee that we can actually support all the positions in the managerial level that we have. So we're in a very tight position with regard to the ability to continue to support everything that we're doing. And so that's why I went back earlier. What are some of the things that you're doing that we don't need to be doing? And we could try to think about one way to get at that. The 0 to 5 mobility is a function of a lot of things, but one of them is this inability to make commitments beyond a certain number of years because we don't know what our budget is going to be like. So I'm sorry that that's the case, but it is the case. No, I think it's a fair question. It is the case. We don't know what our resources are going to look like down the road. The single largest group of individuals, by the way, the single largest percentage increase of individuals are you. Over the course of the last 5 years, if you look at the staffing reports, we've actually increased the number of administrative and support staff at McGill faster than we increased the professoriate. Now, in the first 5 years of the decade, we increased the professoriate faster. But there is this kind of cycles in terms of what we're trying to do. We can't have professors here without having good support. We can't do it certainly without facilities development. And so we know we have some commitments we have to make. But it's really difficult when we don't know where some of the next marginal dollars are going to be coming from, and including tuition and government support. We're still very much in that game, but I appreciate your comments, and I'm sure Lynn has heard them and will reflect on them. Yes. Right. But there are, just to be really clear, labor legislation in Quebec is pretty strong, and we operate with even stronger commitments to individuals hired before 1997 at McGill. So there's 30 years is covered. But productivity is really important, and I think that's one of the things that all of us have to get used to. I mean, even as academics, we're continually evaluated. 75% of our annual increases in merit are based on performance. So that developing that kind of a sense of your own ability to contribute and the things that you do will give you a sense of security because you become an important contributor to the university's success. So I'm sure you're already doing that, but you know, keep it up. Right. Yeah. Right. Right. I think that's the mobility question is a really important one, and I know that came up in the career planning as well, the work group, and Lynn, I know, has some opinions. The question is, sometimes mobility internally at McGill is difficult, and we often see recruitment from outside individuals coming in when someone inside might have been suitable for the position. And the questions are probably, I'm going to put it, I think it's a great question, it's an important one, but it also has to do with what happens if you, in developmental assignments in particular, move to a different position, the unit in which you're located is now short-staffed and they have to rely on someone to backfill, et cetera. So I think it's a really important question and one that we haven't come to grips with, which is how do we encourage internal mobility without it having negative effects on units and individuals. So I think that's one I'm going to leave with Lynn to come back to, because I think it's something that really is about career development at the university. I think we need, and just I don't mean to contrast our two interlocutors before, but it's important to have a balance between individuals who are mobile and bring contributions for a period of time and those who are stable. We see it in the professoriate as well. There are cosmopolitans and locals, right? There are people who bring for a certain period of time something to the university, but then they move on, and other people who are stalwarts and continue to plug away. These two things don't have to be in conflict with each other. They can be complementary to each other, and we have to think about that. There are skills that come from outside that we absolutely need that we haven't been able up till now to develop, and there are people who have institutional knowledge and know their way around the institution who are making invaluable contributions to our success. We've got to bring those two groups together and not have them in opposition to each other. Another question was addressed to the VPRIR. McGill seems missing in action when it comes to the world of 21st century research data management, archiving, etc. Who is looking after this important part of the future of knowledge here? And then the second part of it was, how do reductions in operating budgets affect our research community? The second one is a bit easier to answer for me, and I'll come back to the first one next. The first question, the reductions in operating budgets affect the ability of the research community to complete research grants in a timely fashion, to make sure everything is done appropriately, that everything is filled out. So if we don't have good support for filling out research grants, we lose a very significant component of McGill's overall budget. The overall budget of the university now depends, if you look at it globally, it's about $1.2 billion a year. And a significant component of that, up to $500 million a year, comes from research grants either directly to the university or through the research institutes in our hospitals, our affiliated hospitals. So if we don't provide good support through the operating budget for our researchers, they can't get access to the funds they need to conduct their research. We do very little internal subsidization of research at McGill. That's not the way in which a major research university works. We put our professors in a position to compete for external funds to support their research activities. We don't provide direct subsidies for their research. There are very few, I said, exceptions to that. We sometimes provide stipends in the form, research stipends for people who hold specific chairs at McGill. But those are a really small component of the total operating budget. In fact, they're a very small component of the operating budget or the research budget, less than 1%. So that's not how the effect would be on not having the support to get the research done. professors, and you talk about instability, professors have to are really entrepreneurs. They get research grants, they run big laboratories, they hire clerical, technical, and scientific support. And their research depends on government funding being available. And what we're witnessing in Ottawa is a collapse of the amount of money that's going to be made available for research in the future. Basic research is what drives a university, curiosity-driven research. So we have to make sure our professors are in a position to compete for that research. Because if they lose their research funding, then some people who may have been here 20 or 30 years will wind up not having positions in at the university because we don't have the funds to pay them. That's all soft-funded money. So we have to be, again, it can have an effect, a double effect, if we don't, if we're not careful. I think we're doing much better in terms of thinking about the problems of research data management, but I'm going to pass this question on to the VP Research and we'll post an answer to it. We have a project that is trying to make sure we have complete CVs in the R2R project, and that we're also, I saw the beginning, I had Yogi Berra. At the end, I'll have another Yankee. I hate to do it. But the issue that we're trying to deal with there is I think we should have a baseball card about every professor at the university. Right? Here's your batting average, and here are the students you're teaching. Here's the amount of space you're occupying. Here's the graduate students you're supervising. You know, a statistics profile so that we'll be in a better understanding of the individual contributions that people make. It's an important thing to be able to do because it also will help us to figure out how to retain people who we're afraid will leave us after some number of years and investments that we make. It's very costly to give someone tenure at the university because once they have tenure, they have expectations about their future career trajectories themselves. They have expectations about laboratories and physical space. They have expectations about their teaching loads, and we have to be able to respond to that. So knowing more about data management is important. We have obligations on research data to retain it almost in perpetuity from now on because there are questions of research integrity. Has the data been handled appropriately? And if someone else wants to do a reanalysis of it, is it available? So we do have to look at that. But I'll have Rose Goldstein take a look at that. I don't see her here today. So last question that I had was, what can I do to contribute? Well, get involved. Again, I think you have to be willing to make suggestions and not be fearful of making suggestions that affect your immediate work environment or something that you see affecting the university as a whole. And I do mean it. If we hadn't had that suggestion about the fact that we were falling behind in terms of electronic handling of applications for academic appointments at McGill, we wouldn't right now be using a third-party provider or have the project R2R. So make the suggestions. We listen to them. We can't always implement them, but they're important. The other thing is to volunteer where you can to be part of different work groups because consultation is really part of what makes a university a university. So where there are groups that you might be able to make a contribution to, please get involved. Make suggestions to groups like this about what you'd like to see on their agendas and what you'd like to bring forward to senior administrators to work with. And when there are faculty councils, town halls, or other outreach sessions, come to them. I'm preaching to the converted, right? But come to them. And do send your suggestions to the email addresses that we've provided. I'm going to just quickly, I know we're running a little late, so I'm just going to quickly go over what ASAP is. That's the new strategic academic paper of the university. And there were dozens. I mean, consultation was how we built it. And the reason I did it through these large number of consultation groups was the first time I wrote a paper back in 2006 for the university. It was called Strengths and Aspirations, and it was the first academic white paper the university had. And I built it from consultations with only deans. And I made the assumption that my colleagues had been consulting broadly with chairs and chairs with professors and with other employee groups throughout the faculties. And the first time I made a presentation to a group like this back in 2007, people shook their heads and said, "What is this? Where did this come from?" And some of them were faculty members, and I thought, "Well, this is strange." there wasn't enough consultation. So this time around, I didn't avoid the deans. And after all, as the chief academic officer after the principal, the deans report to me. And as the chief budget officer, most of the time, deans have to be nice to me. So I did consult broadly with deans, but I also brought it to Senate 6 times. I went out and met with the chairs and directors in faculties, not just with the deans. I went to every faculty council at least once in the course of the consultations. I went to all the student councils of the large associations and to some of the smaller faculty associations as well. I came to Management Forum with the presentation the first time. I've met with various work groups and we had administrative and academic units with whom I've met. And many people came to the open forums, which Rose Goldstein and I held together, or managed to provide some communication through thoughtful feedback online. So we couldn't have built an academic paper for the university without all of that participation. Consultation really does matter, no matter what the student press says. I talked about McGill's mission. McGill is research intensive. And that really is our defining characteristic. This is an institution where the professors are expected to push forward, not hold back, the frontiers of knowledge, right? So they have to be at the cutting edge of their disciplines. We want them to be that when we hire them, and there's a ratcheting up effect. Young professors who we hire today, I tell the chairs and deans this all the time, they should be better than we were. It's a ratcheting up. We want to see professors coming to McGill who are truly outstanding in their fields. At the same time, we're a university, not a research institute, so we want them to teach our students. We want them to be involved in undergraduate teaching where appropriate and in graduate supervision as well. We're committed to excellence. Probably overused word, but it's something we really do believe in at McGill. We want quality and excellence, and we want people to have access to us. So it's important that anyone who's talented should have an opportunity to be at McGill. We don't want to hold people back because they can't afford it or because there's some other thing holding them back. We also want to judge ourselves against the highest international standards. We compete worldwide for the professors we now have. We've got professors from over 60 different countries around the world who've gotten PhDs from a dozen different countries around the world. We really want to make sure that our professors are at the top level of their game. And we can see this in terms of, you don't have to believe all the rankings, right? But we do really well. In Canada, it's clear we do well. When you look at the world rankings, we're in the top 25 or 30 or top 50. You know, somewhere. We're ranked among the best universities in the world, and that's something we should all be proud of. And we hope that you're proud of the work that our professors do, because they couldn't do it without your support. We need to make sure that we're supporting that mission of professors and students being excellent and comparing themselves worldwide. But we're also a publicly funded university. My colleagues in the United States talked about state universities, like University of California. And they'd say, well, in the 1960s, we were state-funded. In the 1990s, we were state-assisted. And today, we're state-located, right? Because government appropriations have simply withered away. In some of our public universities in the United States, government grants now represent less than double-digit percentages of their operating budgets. And we're still at very close to 40%, 50%. So we have a long way to go to get diversification in our sources of revenue, and depending so heavily on a government is something that is not always going to serve our interests well. We're not a public university in the traditional sense. We are publicly funded, but we have an independent charter. But we depend on government funding from our students, because that's how we're operating. But we still, even if we weren't publicly funded, we have a strong sense of public purpose. Our research and the training and education we provide to our students really matter in terms of the impact that they have on the community. I presented a year ago an outline of the 2006 papers and considered a way forward. We went through all of this with Management Forum a while ago. There were 3 big work groups. in which the managerial staff has played an important role. One is supporting the academic mission and in particular services for students. The other was on career development and administrative support staff across the university. And the third was thinking about the professions, and to some extent that may go back to access to better educational opportunities and training for people who are already here at McGill through the best possible resources that we have. One of the things I learned going out to the consultations with our for the paper was just how incredibly rich we are in terms of our human resources. Every time I read a dossier of someone new, a new professor coming to McGill, every time I look at a tenure file, every time I look at a promotion to full professor or read about the awards that our professors win all the time, it's a truly superlative faculty. Now, that might not always correspond to your individual interactions with them, but as a group, they are absolutely spectacular. Our students are exemplary. Now, one of the problems with McGill, and it is a problem, I think, we only admit students on the basis of their grades. So we don't do holistic assessment of files. This has an impact on our ability to be diverse. It's hard to have a diverse campus unless you have something other than grades that you're using to assess whether you should be admitted or not. And the other thing, in this talking to all of you, is just how dedicated and talented you are in the roles that you play in the university. And when you put those three things together, it really makes for a spectacular university. And the recognition we get, I think, is well deserved, because at every level, McGill is outperforming the resource base that we have. Our professors are, of the 15 universities in the U15 in Canada, our professors are actually paid at about the 12th rank, right? Not even in the top 10. When we look at our students are coming and we provide them with scholarships and with student aid, mostly thanks to philanthropic gifts, not because of access to Quebec student aid. And our support staff are dedicated and hardworking, and even though there's mobility and there's some insecurity, we generally see people really dedicated to performing in their jobs. This is a truly international university at the undergraduate level, and I don't know if we reflect enough on it or if you see it. Most publicly funded universities will have about 3 to 8% of their undergraduate population coming from a jurisdiction other than their own. At McGill, we have about 50, just over 50% of our students are from Quebec, and almost half of them have a mother tongue other than English, and a large percentage come from Francophone cégeps. Another group of students, almost a quarter, come from other Canadian provinces or territories, and just about a fifth of our students come from a foreign country. And although the United States is the most widely represented, it's not at all alone, and there are students at any one time on our campus from about 100 different countries. So it's a truly international place, and we have to, I think, as a professor here, I'm really proud of that, because I think it shows the ability of this university to attract people from wide geographic disbursement across the globe. But we're not as representative here. We don't have represented here as many students from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. And I have to say that, for me, is, I guess on a personal note, a bit disappointing. I can say, my parents were immigrants to the United States. Neither of them finished the eighth grade. And I think we should be attracting more people with that kind of a background who can really succeed here, but we're just not able to do it because we don't have holistic admissions, and it costs a lot of money to do something like that. But we have to start thinking. We don't have enough Aboriginal students here, First Nations and Métis and other autochthon groups. We have to be able to have outreach. In some of our faculties, although women are now the dominant force on the campus as undergraduate students, we're still not attracting women in great enough numbers into PhD programs. And I think that we've not done enough to reach out, even in our own community, to groups that are underrepresented on the campus, on our campus, but are represented in our population base. So we have to have more outreach. We have to get out there and try to do something to bring people here who come from diverse backgrounds. Our diversity is geographic, it's not socioeconomic, and it's not overwhelmingly ethnic or in terms of our First Nations populations. Question there. Right. I think that it's diversity among the faculty is a really important consideration, and we certainly are now trying to do more than we've ever done before to ensure, at least for women, that there's more access to faculty positions. We're not in the United States, so we don't actually collect a lot of data on the backgrounds of the people who are recruited into positions. We don't have the same statistical affirmative action programs that exist there, so we don't have a lot of information. Now that we're using an American service for some of our external recruitment, and as we build R2R, we may put voluntary questions up front to allow us to do that. Right now, the only requirement we have with regard to potentially underrepresented groups in faculty is if a woman is in the top 10 of any competition, she must be interviewed for the job. That at least gives one opportunity. One of the things you have to remember, I just said, is that we don't have enough women who are actually in the PhD programs, and that's the access you have to getting a professorial position. McGill is keeping up with the average number of women receiving PhDs and being recruited into tenure-track positions, but that's not good enough for us. Being just average shouldn't be where we're pointing. So we're looking to do more for diversity. The Principal's Task Force certainly took this issue on, and we want to address it with regard to as many of the groups who are underrepresented as possible. I don't want successors 25 years from now still talking about why we have so few women studying engineering. The answer turns out because we have so few women engineering professors. What are we doing now to correct that? This is not going to be turned over in a day. This is going to take decades or more. But if we have the commitment, I think we can move on. I think we've run out of time, and I'm standing between you and lunch. I'd say that there are three basic strategic objectives that we have. One is to ensure McGill's academic success and our profile for excellence and our reputation nationally and internationally. The second is to continue to be student-centered in our focus. Even our researchers should be bringing their research into the classroom. That's the advantage that a student has at McGill coming here, is they have the advantage of being in front of people who are producing the knowledge that goes into textbooks. So they have that advantage. But if our professors don't use inquiry-based knowledge, then the student-centeredness on that research focus will be lost. So we have to encourage our professors at all levels to bring research into the classroom. And the third is something we all can do, and in particular those of you who are in managerial positions at the university, is help us to optimize the way in which we use the existing resources. Ask the hard questions. Don't take facile answers. Don't be pushy, but be assertive, right? Try to make it clear that there are things that can be done that aren't being done, and there are things we're doing that we don't need to do, because we know you know more. The shop floor question is really relevant. Bring that home to people. I'm going to say that the rest of this you can get online, and I'm going to just say there are three more points. Priorities that we've set in the white paper will be a measure of success. To the extent to which people actually understand the priorities, goals, objectives for the next 5 years, including groups like yours, will be, I'll measure that as a success for the ASAP. The second is, it really is a roadmap. And someone raised the question earlier, I guess it was Victor, raised the question earlier. What are we going to have to cut? Well, when you have a strategic paper, you know what you shouldn't cut, right? So it's really important to outline carefully in the strategic paper the things you know you have to do to remain competitive. And it should be the driver for all of your resource allocations. And if we had an endorsement by Senate, but now we want to make sure it's fully endorsed by the rest of the community, which is why I go out to these groups to talk a little bit about it. I didn't talk much about it. I'll put it online for you to read. There are a lot of questions that I'll put up as well. And I didn't get to the budget, but I'm going to just quickly give you a couple of questions that you raised. Given the tuition freeze and the likely continuation of zero or low increases in the future, what are you considering to balance the budget in the coming years? I don't know if you submitted that question or if you just asked it ahead of time. Right now, we're in a major consultation with all of the people who manage the budgets. We're trying a new project at McGill, which is a project to integrate. Now, we're trying to be much more transparent. right? The budget presentation at McGill has won an award 2 years in a row for linking, planning, and being transparent. But it doesn't sink down layers below the faculty. So we're trying to integrate better the way in which finances and the budget integrate. So in the interest of transparency, we designed a project at McGill called FBI. Anyway, there's a bunch of other things that are on here which I'm not going to get to. There were a couple of realities that we really do need to face as I build the budget, and these are the last points I'll raise. We know we need to adjust people's salaries. Even if inflation is low, everyone has an expectation. There's a mortgage to pay, there are kids to educate, there's family considerations. So salary adjustments need to be made regularly for people to feel like they're advancing in their own personal careers and that the institution cares about them. But if I do nothing, hire nobody else, we have everybody here who's here, nobody leaves, nobody stays, every year, just to give a 1% or 2% increase in salary, we're looking at $5 to $7 million, and that's we have to then raise those revenues from somewhere else. So keeping the size of the university the same has a big cost. There are serious concerns, although not, I don't think it's yet a crisis, but I think we should begin to think about it as a crisis, with our pension system. We have to act in a way that will help us to understand our pension better. That's a responsibility for all of you, as well as for those of us in administration. Up until 2008, to be quite honest, I knew nothing about pensions. But I learned really fast as we began to experience crises with regard to our ability to have enough liquidity and enough value in the pension to pay all our obligations. We have an endowment fund, but we don't live off of the endowment fund. We live off the interest of the endowment fund. So remember I said we had a $100 million deficit at McGill? We're only paying 1% interest, so it's only $1 million a year. Take the other side of that. We have an endowment fund. It's only generating 1% or 2% a year. So where is the other obligations coming from? We've got a deferred maintenance problem that is frightening. It's an old campus, and we've ignored a lot of it, and every time we do something, we find something nasty going on. So we have to fix it. What if interest rates go up? On the one hand, endowment payouts might go up. On the other hand, we have to pay more on the accumulated deficit. We need money to compete for research. So that was another question, I think, embedded in the question earlier. Research funding, not direct, but we have to put money aside to match research obligations that are coming from other sources, like the Canada Excellence Chairs. And we have special constraints in Quebec universities. We've already talked about Bill 100. And here are the problems we're going to face. Economic austerity is going to be on the agenda of governments at the national and provincial levels. It can't be otherwise. Quebec can't turn into another Greece, right? I mean, we've got huge debt. Something is going to happen. What are the trade-offs that we can accept in without compromising quality and access? How are we going to reduce our liabilities and our carrying costs? How are we going to increase efficiency and productivity? What are the consequences that we're now facing with regard to our deficits? And how can we augment our revenue streams? I'll end with another Yankee. Babe Ruth once said, "Yesterday's home runs don't win today's games." And that means we have to change, and we can only change if you help us change. So thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Provost Massey. That was very generous of you to go over all of this stuff and to spend all this time with us, and even more generous to provide lunch with wine later. We appreciate that. So, you did. And we also have to thank your wonderful staff, Sharon Baccaro and Nancy Diamond, who were very helpful in helping us put this all together. And I'd like to thank my colleagues on the Management Forum Steering Committee, who were very instrumental in putting this together as well. Thank you. I just have two quick announcements to make. One is that the Management Forum Conference is coming up in February. The date is hopefully going to be February 20th, but that's not totally nailed down yet. We'll let you know that as soon as we can. The theme for this year's conference is going to be neighborhood. We're all members of different neighborhoods, and we all come together in the bigger neighborhood that is McGill, and we hope to work around that theme. We hope to have some organized interactive sessions, and we're very excited to have as our keynote speaker this year Professor Steve McGuire from the Faculty of Management, Desautels Faculty of Management, who is the director of the Marcel Desautels Institute for Integrative Management. So I'm sure he'll have a lot of good things for us to hear. So that's it. There are flip charts located outside in both of the lunchrooms so that if you want to add comments, put down questions, anything like that, they'll be given to the provost afterwards. So just to thank you one more time. We appreciate it very much. And lunch is served. Thank you very much.